Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now on to the episode.
Hello and welcome to Jane's World of Intelligence Live, coming to you from DSEI 2025. I'm Kate Cox, your host for today and the Director of Strategic Programs in Jane's Analysis Division. Today we'll be talking about the future of open source intelligence, a popular topic with listeners of the Jane's podcast. And to guide us through this important topic, I have our panel next to me. So listeners of the podcast will be familiar with Sean Corbett, the chair of the National Security Advisory Board. Welcome, Sean.
Okay. Hello, everybody.
Right. We also have Phil Smith with us, the chief technology officer at Jane's. Hello, Phil.
Hello, everyone.
And we have Liam Dirt van Bokhoven, our chief commercial officer at Jane's. Hello, Liam Dirt.
Thank you, Kate.
Great. So we're here to talk about OSINT, what it is, how decision makers and analysts engage with it, and the challenges and opportunities that it presents. If there's time at the end of the discussion, we'll also open this up to some audience participation. So please do have a think about any questions you might like to ask our panelists. But before that, there is a lot to discuss, so let's dive in. Sean, to set the scene, how would we define OSINT, and how can it take us from raw data to informed decision-making?
As ever, Kate, that could take up the entire podcast, just in terms of defining intelligence, because there's not actually an accepted definition of it. Don't worry, I'm not going to go down a real rabbit warren, but those of you who have heard the podcast before, for me, there are four distinct elements to open source intelligence, two of which are also common to intelligence as a whole. And the first of those basically is it has to be applied to a problem set or a challenge or a difficult problem. It can't just sort of willy-nilly. And a lot of the challenge on that is actually setting the right question. So generally the problem set is, in our case, security or defense related, is to enable decision makers to make their best decisions. So that's the first element of all it. The second, and it's really important to distinguish between intelligence and information, is that intelligence is incomplete information. My analogy, if you like, is it's a jigsaw puzzle. So hopefully most people will be aware of what a jigsaw puzzle is. But it's like taking the top of the box off and finding that a lot of the pieces are missing. Some of the pieces are parts of another jigsaw puzzle, and some have even had the picture torn off. And the idea is to get to a stage where you come up with as near to the picture as you possibly can. Now, the problem used to be always about that there weren't just enough pieces. The problem we've got now is that there are probably thousands of pieces of millions of jigsaw puzzles in the same box. So that's what's changed. So that's the second thing. The third thing from an OSINT perspective, clearly, is it's got to be either publicly available or commercially available. And there is so much good data out there that you can just get, either you can buy it or it's just out there. That is both a threat and an opportunity. The amount of data, which is just crazy right now, but not all of it's right. And no doubt we'll come and talk about that a little bit later. And then for a company like Jane's and most of us in the West, it has to be, the way we collect that data has to be both legal and ethical. Now, that's not the case always with our adversaries, and we need to be conscious of that. But, you know, there are ways of collecting data that are legitimate and allow us to use them in a good way. You know, we're talking about data privacy and that sort of stuff. So in a nutshell, that's how I define it.
Yeah. Do you think it's still a useful term?
OSINT? I do. And the reason I think it's still useful is because I don't think the community is yet in the place where OSINT is just a normal intelligence. So it's a really good question, because we need to start thinking beyond OSINT and beyond classified intelligence, because it is incumbent on an analyst to consider all elements of the data, whether it's from classified sources or not. And the intelligence community has been through a journey, definitely, over the last probably 5 to 10 years. 5 years ago, there were many in the community that wouldn't consider open source intelligence to be an intelligence discipline at all. Now, we're beyond that now. In fact, we're getting to a place, we might talk about later, where, you know, is OSINT a relevant phase, a phrase rather, because it does compartment it. Whereas if you look at the sources of OSINT, you can get commercial satellite imagery, you can get, obviously, social media intelligence, as we call it, all other forms of intelligence, which are subsets of what we've known in the big intelligence world, you know, as SIGINT, HUMINT, et cetera, et cetera. So, and we have to incorporate all those into it. So it's still relevant in terms of how we're looking to develop it, but it should be becoming less relevant in terms of compartmenting it. It's just part of intelligence.
Mm. So we've talked a little bit about what OSINT is. It would also be good to talk about why it's useful. So, Leander, could you tell us a little bit about why OSINT matters and what benefits it offers analysts and decision makers in the defence and security space?
Yeah, thanks, Kate. And let me build on what Sean just mentioned, that the definition of OSINT, so to say, to a certain extent, could be too limited, I think, because we're nowadays talking about information from open sources, whatever they are, basically, and then being applied to different use cases across defense and intelligence organizations. So when we're talking about the value of what that brings to the table, I think I would summarize it by three T's at this point in time. So first of all, I mean, time. There's a time value, a benefit of what OSINT brings to the table. I think the things are moving so fast nowadays. There's so much out in the open. And I think the time value of searching that data and analyzing that, using that in your analysis, I think that is a major, I think, advantage and a value it brings to the table for defense and intelligence organizations. By the way, not all OSINT is created equal. We're not just scraping the internet, but this is also the question, like, where does the analysis get into that before it's being used in decision-making processes? So there's a time element, I think, which is really very, very, very important. And of course, what we as Jane's bring to the table is a bit of context of that information as well, because over the past years, we've developed a data model or ontologies and so on that describe the data in its context. And so that gives the analysts, I think, a time advantage of using that data in their decision-making process. So I think it's indispensable nowadays in the contemporary Intel environment to use that information. And recently, the number of sources that are from the open source is just still growing every day. And yet, on the other hand, they've got that time issue, that how fast can you derive insights from that? So I think one of the key values, I think, and benefits also bring to the table is a time element. The second thing is, I think, is trust. If done properly, it will bring an element of trust. And just let me talk from Jane's perspective. What we bring together is foundational data, current data, so on. We've consistently and accurately assessed that. That gives an element of trust, I think, to the OSINT data that we're using. And especially in the environment in which I operate as well. I mean, for example, in NATO, there's a lot of importance given to the trust of the information. Can you trust that source? Can you use that in your processes? And is it then shareable then also across the coalition so that you can build on that? And do you trust where it came from? Do you trust the model by which it was created and so on? Is it shareable across the coalition? But also, is it shareable across use cases? Mm. And that, again, builds trust. So if you can use the same data or the same underlying OSINT, so to say, across your operational systems and your planning systems and your long-term capability systems, that, again, helps build trust, I think. Maybe the third value I want to bring in here, so besides time, trust, I think it has transformational value as well. If done properly, what we're trying to do is integrate data at the data level. And basically what we're trying to build is that the interconnected data set that can be used to further enhance and further integrate other sources in that as well. And that provides transformational value, I think. We're not just integrating things at the screen, so to say, or at an application level, but we're fundamentally integrating data and bringing OSINT together in a trusted environment, in an environment where you can exploit that through integrated means. So I think time, trust, and the transformational value, I think that's what our customers are looking for. That's what defense and intelligence organizations are trying to apply. And if you then, on top of that, would say, I want to apply modern technology to exploit that, like AI, for example, you do need information sets like this. Will you be able to exploit this at scale and in relevant in the context in which you want to exploit it? So if you want to use AI to exploit it, I think data sets, OSINT data sets, are crucially important for that. So that's, I think, the value what OSINT brings to the table, if done properly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, a couple of points on technology that I definitely want to come back to on Phil. But turning to some of the challenges, thinking about the processing challenge in particular. So I think, Linda, Sean, you've both touched on the vast amount of OSINT at our fingertips now, which is both a great resource for researchers, but also presents a huge processing challenge. And some talk about it now as the democratization of information, don't they? So, Sean, how can we navigate some of these OSINT challenges?
So, firstly, I want to talk about democratization of data, because it's an easy phrase, but it's a really bad one, because not all data is equal. And this does help to answer your question, actually. So how do you get through the all those jigsaw pieces to get to the right one? Well, it's down to tradecraft, effectively. It's being able to validate, assure the pieces of information, check your assumptions, and really work through in an objective way, is that data helping me to answer the question? And you can't nowadays, you just cannot do it in the old way. You know, I bet you they're out there, there are people within the intelligence community still using Excel spreadsheets to manage their data and then come up with the good things. You just simply can't do that now. So you're going to have to, in some way, and I'm sure Phil will come on talk with us in a minute, in the collection phase, you've got to be able to filter to an extent where you get all of the relevant information, but only the relevant information. That has always been a massive challenge for the intelligence community. There is just simply too much information out there to do it in a manual way. And I think the second thing to say, really, is the integration of classified and unclassified data, which we've already mentioned a little bit. But, you know, it is incumbent upon an analyst to make sure they use all the information. Mm. You hear the term all source analysis. Nobody does all source analysis because they don't have access to all source. So it's at best it's multiple source. But you're almost, by working behind, you know, firewalls and all the rest of it, you're already unconsciously biasing yourselves to certain sort of data. And that is a real challenge. So, Phil, do you want to sort of talk a little bit more about that side and what you guys are doing to get through it?
Yeah, I think for me, the role in the cycle for the AI is to be able to do the collection and the discovery. So what you might call narrow AI, be able to summarize information, be able to drive it forward. So in the context of the cycle, what you're trying to do is make sure that the technology is teaming with the humans in that process and is pulling the data through. So I think at Jane's and in a lot of other organizations, what you're seeing is people try to process the volume, filter it down, discover the things that are relevant, and then be able to push them into the analyst to then be able to do that contextual analysis.
Mm. Do you see, Phil, technology, and particularly AI, as an enabler or accelerant for OSINT?
Yeah, I think it's both. So the potential for AI is obviously huge. I think there are challenges about how you execute it, how you engineer it, how you manage expectations. So, you know, people are used to using AI, you know, ChatGPT, day-to-day as a personal productivity tool. But using it inside an OSINT cycle is quite different.
Mm.
And so there's a piece about, and I'll go on to this a bit later on, there's a bit about how do you use it, how do you leverage it in a really efficient way? Because what you don't want to do is create noise. Mm. So when we at Jane first started using AI to process data in our discovery pipelines, what we were generating is a lot of noise that then the analysts had to filter back out. So over time, we've been tuning that to try and be very, you know, increase the efficacy of what we're doing so that what you're doing is feeding things that are useful to the analyst rather than feeding, you know, what you're trying to do is go from a high noise ratio to very, very low noise ratio, not from high to medium.
Mm.
And I think that's important. Following up on your point, Sean.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about the human machine teaming as part of the OSINT. How can we do that most effectively? How does that kind of work the best,
so,
really?
So for me, I think there's, if you think about what AI is really good at, it's good at processing language. Mm. It's good at managing high volumes of data. So one of the key things at the moment is we want to use AI inside a process. And so if you think about what's happening in the AI space at the moment, the models are evolving incredibly quickly. What's also happening is that the frameworks you need a framework to then embed the AI model into a process. Now, the frameworks are very immature at the moment. So what we're seeing is the evolution of frameworks that then allow people to embed the AI into an effective OSINT process in a more maintainable way. And one of the really important things about this is any AI solution you build today, because the models are evolving, because the frameworks are evolving, I can guarantee you, whatever you build today, you'll be rebuilding in 6 months' time or a year's time or 2 years' time. Well, actually, probably all of them. So one of the interesting things about that is if you don't want to build a thing that's very rapidly going to become obsolete and unmaintainable, what you have to be able to do is engineering things to be modular. So if you look at agentic AI obviously has great potential for OSINT. But actually, you're going to have to build it in a modular way because lots of the bits you're going to be replacing every 3 months. Because otherwise, other people are going to have built something. If I was to build a thing in 6 months' time, it'll be better than the thing I would build today. So building things so that they're maintainable, so that it's sustainable, so that they will continue to add value and push the boundary of what's doable is going to be really at the core of anything you do.
And I'd just add that I think we need to, particularly in the analyst world, we need to get comfortable with that. We've got to get comfortable with consistent development. You know, we're very good about setting up policies and our tradecraft and all the rest. We go, right, that's it, now it's set. We can't think about it anymore like that. We've got to think about it, right, okay, what's the next thing, what's the next thing, what's the next thing? Just back on the AI and how useful it is right now, just a quick one, is that one thing AI does very well is trend analysis, pattern analysis. So I always go back to the Arab Spring, where had we had AI at that stage that was looking at, say, the global wheat prices, we would probably have predicted the Arab Spring in terms of all the different things that contributed to to making it happen in the way that it happened, but all the other inputs as well that were happening around the world. We should have been able to predict it, actually, but that still would have needed the analyst saying, okay, what does this mean? And I think it's going to be a while before, if ever, we get to the stage where the analyst can go, I don't need to do that anymore. Yeah. You've got to have, at some stage, the human has to be in the loop. And a lot of that comes with, you know, everybody thinks they can do OSINT right now by just Googling stuff. It's just not like that. You know, your analyst is pretty, you know, in-depth, understands the area in which they're in, the context, you know, the so what, the what if. And so if anything, and I don't know if we're going to have time to come on to misinformation, disinformation, but if anything doesn't look right, they will have that background, that knowledge, that experience to go, something is not quite right here. And then that's when you can go in and say, okay, let's have a look at the data. What looks, you know, what's accurate, what isn't. So it's a complex issue.
Yeah.
So I would say three elements. What I'm constantly hearing, so to say, it's about the data itself, the trustworthiness of the data, but the analysts are an essential part of that, and the underlying technology about how do you deliver that, how do you accelerate that cycle. The combination of these three, the data, the analyst, and technology being brought together, that will give that, I think, the necessary acceleration of the use and adoption of of OSINT in decision making.
I totally agree. And also, one of the things that gets overlooked is people talk about the data, but the AI engine needs context as well, which you talked about earlier, Linda. And to provide context, you don't just need the foundational data. What you also need is the data schema. And what you need is the data framework that then integrates into the technology framework. So what you see is, you know, you got this thing about vibe coding. I can build a proof of concept for something to do with AI and OSINT in a day, but it'd be wildly inaccurate. It will create me inconsistent results. To build that same thing, but well-engineered, sustainable, will give a high degree of accuracy up into the high 99% and above. That requires the context, it requires structure, it requires all those engineering disciplines that allow you to then create that consistency. Because picking up on the point Sean made, one of the risks is actually, particularly with the next generation of analysts, they will believe the AI at face value at some point. So at some point, you have to be very, very, very close to 100% efficacy. Otherwise, you're going to be generating your own misinformation. And that's only going to get worse because we're now in the early stages of AI models being trained on data generated by other AI. And that's going to create all sorts of odd effects that people don't really truly understand yet.
Yeah. So I think conscious of time, we'll move towards the end of the discussion now. and each pull out a key takeaway to leave our live audience and podcast listeners later on with from the discussion. I mean, from what we've just been discussing now, I think for me, it's the dual importance of people and technology, and also data, as you mentioned just now. So we rightly talk a lot about technology and the promise of AI, but we shouldn't overlook the continued importance of the analyst and the human in the loop as well. So I think, as Sean was saying earlier, technology can help us cut through the noise and identify patterns in a way that would take an analyst a very long time to do manually. But equally, that critical thinking and contextual understanding and judgment is an essential piece of the puzzle which the analyst provides too. So I think the bottom line for me is we need both. Sean, what's your key takeaway?
So mine is we need a sense of urgency. You know, the title of this is The Future Intelligence. Well, The Future Intelligence is now. Well, it was actually 5 years ago, but we can't go back in time. But, you know, the community and writ large, you know, whether that is coalitions, whether that's national governments, are still worrying over, okay, where does OSINT fit? What does it even mean? I mean, there was a US intelligence community policy document, came out last year, 6 pages, took them 2 years to write it. And everyone's going, oh, yeah, excellent, we're done, tick. But who is actually doing it for real in an efficient way? You're still having discussions about, do we need an OSINT agency? Which for me would be absolutely crazy, but you know. So the usual thing with any government organization is that we need to, particularly in light of what Phil and Linda were saying, we just need to embrace it and throw it in there, integrate it as much as we possibly can into the normal processes. And bring it to light. And I'm just not sure we've understood the urgency, because you can be sure that our adversaries and potential adversaries out there are doing exactly that. They don't have the same ethical or legal concerns as we've seen overnight. So we've got to get real about this, and we've got to start doing it properly. And the only way to do it properly is true. And of course, I would say this, but it is true. True, you know, government industry partnerships.
Mm, absolutely. Phil, what's your takeaway?
My takeaway is this requires a degree of execution discipline that is just the same level of execution discipline we've always had. And therefore, what that leads you to is we're in a race. We're in a race for talent, analysts, technologists, data people. We're in a race for innovation of the technologies. We're in a race for building data centers that can be able to run that many GPUs. So it's picking up on the same thing, but from a different angle, which is, there is a belief in some quarters that we will be able to execute this in very lightweight and the technology will do the work for us. We've been saying that for 30 years. It's never happened. We're in a race for talent. We're in a race for technology innovation. And we have to shrink the cycle time, which we've heard a lot of people talking about here at DSEI over the last couple of days on all the stands. Mm. We've got to shrink the cycle. Got to go faster. And I think it's about that at its heart.
Yeah. And Linda?
Yeah, let me build on that. I wrote down the word accelerating. First of all, so many things are accelerating. The future is now basically, and the number of data sources will be more, and will be, and the pace of that will be accelerated. For me, the big question is, how do we connect that to decision making? Mm. How do we ultimately make sure there is a connection between the data based on which we make our decision? So, decision advantage that everybody's looking for. I think the holy grail is still like, how do we do that? And there will be an interplay between humans, data, and technology that will actually enable us to make better and faster decisions. So I think for me, it's all about making better decisions at strategic, operational, tactical levels, and what can open source intelligence contribute to that and not hinder, so to say, an accelerating pace of decision making. So that's, I would say, that for me, the main takeaway.
Thank you. And I'm sure that would be a great springboard for another 30-minute discussion. But I'd like to open this up now to any audience questions that there might be. So please just raise your hands if you have a question for our panelists. Okay, so just to recap the question, it was, if we accelerate too quickly, will the challenge of mis and disinformation become even more of a problem?
That's a great question. And It, as you know, it's one of my real bugbears is that disinformation. We have done several podcasts on it. From my perspective, you know, regardless of what's happening in the world, the greatest threat to Western civilization is disinformation. And the reason I say that is because there is so much out there, you can choose to believe what it is you want to believe. And the filter bubbles and echo chambers, all those things that we come around. You know, we get fed stuff that we want to see. That is a real threat, because with all the data out there, as I said, talked about the democratization of data, not all data is the same, and a lot of it is not true. So how do we get through that? Well, it's a real challenge. So it's got to be a combination of AI, but how do we know that the AI is actually telling us the truth? I mean, you know, if you go on ChatGPT, probably your first source will be probably Wikipedia. Just saying. But equally, it's back to that analytical piece. So it's a very, very big question, and one that I think we're still struggling with. Yes, you can have counter AI, but some of the deep fakes, particularly on the video and the imagery side now, are so good that even the counter AI cannot identify it. You know, you extrapolate that to the future, and you know that's quite a scary place to be.
From a technology angle, the thing I would say is, because the thing was about acceleration, as we accelerate, one of the things we're going to have to be able to do, and I didn't touch on this before, is create feedback loops. So if we're going to use AI extensively, we have to create feedback loops into the AI. And this is one of the things that we're not very good at yet with the technology. So we want to create learning systems that can learn to spot disinformation and misinformation, false positives, false negatives coming out of the AI answers. If we don't do that over time, one would imagine that the quality of the information we get back from these systems will degrade. So I think a really, really important part of this whole cycle is, how do you create learning systems that continue to evolve? And then that's got to be part of your foundational capability, because otherwise your cycles will spin too quick for you to be able to keep up with.
Great. All right. Well, foundational capability, that's a great segue into tomorrow's discussion. We're going to be talking about the importance of foundational intelligence at 1:30 p.m. So if you're around tomorrow, please do come and join us for that. But that brings us to the end of today's panel. So a big thank you to our panelists. Thank you to our audience live here at DSEI today for joining us. And thank you, as always, to the podcast listeners catching up on this later. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.